A Double-Barreled Detective by Mark Twain. Part I.E. Ought never to do wrong when people are looking. The first scene is in the country, in Virginia. The time, 1880. There has been a wedding between a handsome young man of slender means and a rich young girl, a case of love at first sight and a precipitate marriage. A marriage bitterly opposed by the girl's widowed father. Jacob Fuller, the bridegroom, is 26 years old, is of an old, but unconsidered family which had by compulsion emigrated from Sedgemoor, and for King James Perse's profit, so everybody said, some maliciously the rest, merely because they believed it. The bride is 19 and beautiful. She is intense, high-strung, romantic, immeasurably proud of her cavalier blood, and passionate in her love for her young husband. For its sake she braved her father's displeasure, endured his reproaches, listened with loyalty unshaken to his warning predictions, and went from his house without his blessing, proud and happy in the proofs she was thus giving of the quality of the affection which had made its home in her heart. The morning after the marriage there was a sad surprise for her. Her husband put aside her proffered caresses, and said, "Sit down. I have something to say to you. I loved you. That was before I asked your father to give you to me. His refusal is not my grievance, I could have endured that. But the things he said of me to you, that is a different matter. There you needn't speak. I know quite well what they were. I got them from authentic sources. Among other things he said, that my character was written in my face, that I was treacherous, a dissembler, a coward, and a brute without sense of pity or compassion. The Sedgemoor trademark, apostrophe he called it, and white sleeve patch. ... Any other man in my place would have gone to his house, and shot him down like a dog. I wanted to do it, and was minded to do it, but a better thought came to me. To put him to shame, to break his heart, to kill him by inches. How to do it? Through my treatment of you, his idol. I would marry you, and then have patience. You will see. From that moment onward, for 3 months, the young wife suffered all the humiliations, all the insults, all the miseries, that the diligent and inventive mind of the husband could contrive, save physical injuries only. Her strong pride stood by her, and she kept the secret of her troubles. Now and then the husband said, "Why don't you go to your father and tell him?" Then he invented new tortures, applied them, and asked again. She always answered, "He shall never know by my mouth," and taunted him with his origin, said she was the lawful slave of a scion of slaves, and must obey, and would up to that point, but no further. He could kill her if he liked, but he could not break her. It was not in the Sedgemoor breed to do it. At the end of the 3 months he said, with a dark significance in his manner, "I have tried all things but one," and waited for her reply. "Try that," she said, and curled her lip in mockery. That night he rose at midnight and put on his clothes, then said to her, "Get up and dress." She obeyed, as always, without a word. He led her half a mile from the house, and proceeded to lash her to a tree by the side of the public road, and succeeded, she screaming and struggling. He gagged her then, struck her across the face with his cowhide, and set his bloodhounds on her. They tore the clothes off her, and she was naked. He called the dogs off, and said, "You will be found by the passing public. They will be dropping along about 3 hours from now, and will spread the news, do you hear? Goodbye. You have seen the last of me." He went away then. She moaned to herself, "I shall bear a child to him. God grant it may be a boy." The farmers released her by and by and spread the news, which was natural. They raised the country with lynching intentions, but the bird had flown. The young wife shut herself up in her father's house. He shut himself up with her, and thenceforth would see no one. His pride was broken, and his heart. So he wasted away, day by day, and even his daughter rejoiced when death relieved him. Then she sold the estate and disappeared. 2. In 1886, a young woman was living in a modest house near a secluded New England village, with no company but a little boy about 5 years old. She did her own work, she discouraged acquaintanceships, and had none. The butcher, the baker, and the others that served her could tell the villagers nothing about her further than that her name was Stillman, and that she called the child Archie. Whence she came they had not been able to find out, but they said she talked like a southerner. The child had no playmates and no comrade, and no teacher but the mother. She taught him diligently and intelligently, and was satisfied with the results, even a little proud of them. One day Archie said, "Mama, am I different from other children?" "Well, I suppose not. Why?" "There was a child going along out there, and asked me if the postman had been by, and I said yes, and she said how long since I saw him, and I said I hadn't seen him at all, and she said how did I know he'd been by then, and I said, because I smelt his track on the sidewalk, and she said I was a dumb fool, and made a mouth at me." "What did she do that for?" The young woman turned white, and said to herself, "It's a birthmark. The gift of the bloodhound is in him." She snatched the boy to her breast, and hugged him passionately, saying, "God has appointed the way." Her eyes were burning with a fierce light, and her breath came short and quick with excitement. She said to herself, "The puzzle is solved now. Many a time it has been a mystery to me, the impossible things the child has done in the dark, but it is all clear to me now." She set him in his small chair, and said, "Wait a little till I come, dear, then we will talk about the matter." She went up to her room, and took from her dressing table several small articles, and put them out of sight. A nail file on the floor under the bed, a pair of nail scissors under the bureau, a small ivory paper knife under the wardrobe. Then she returned, and said, "There, I have left some things which I ought to have brought down." She named them, and said, "Run up and bring them, dear." The child hurried away on his errand, and was soon back again with the things. "Did you have any difficulty, dear?"
"No, Mama, I only went where you went."
During his absence, as he had stepped to the bookcase, taken several books from the bottom shelf, opened each, passed her hand over a page, noting its number in her memory, then restored them to their places. "Now," she said, "I have been doing something while you have been gone, Archie. Do you think you can find out what it was?" The boy went to the bookcase and got out the books that had been touched and opened them at the pages which had been stroked. The mother took him in her lap and said, "I will answer your question now, dear. I have found out that in one way you are quite different from other people. You can see in the dark, you can smell what other people cannot, you have the talents of a bloodhound. They are good and valuable things to have, but you must keep the matter a secret. If people found it out, they would speak of you as an odd child, a strange child, and children would be disagreeable to you, and give you nicknames. In this world one must be like everybody else, if he doesn't want to provoke scorn or envy or jealousy. It is a great and fine distinction which has been born to you, and I am glad. But you will keep it a secret, for Mama's sake, won't you?" The child promised, without understanding. All the rest of the day the mother's brain was busy with excited thinkings, with plans, projects, schemes, each and all of them uncanny, grim, and dark. Yet they lit up her face, lit it with a fell light of their own. Lit it with vague fires of hell. She was in a fever of unrest. She could not sit, stand, read, so there was no relief for her but in movement. She tested her boy's gift in 20 ways, and kept saying to herself all the time, with her mind in the past: "He broke my father's heart, and night and day all these years I have tried, and all in vain, to think out a way to break his. I have found it now, I have found it now." When night fell, the demon of unrest still possessed her. She went on with her tests,
With a candle she traversed the house from garret to cellar, hiding pins, needles, thimbles, spools, under pillows, under carpets, in cracks in the walls, under the coal in the bin, then sent the little fellow in the dark to find them, which he did, and was happy and proud when she praised him, and smothered him with caresses. From this time forward life took on a new complexion for her. She said, "The future is secure, I can wait, and enjoy the waiting." The most of her lost interest survived. She took up music again, and languages, drawing, painting, and the other long-discarded delights of her maidenhood. She was happy once more, and felt again the zest of life. As the years drifted by, she watched the development of her boy, and was contented with it. Not altogether, but nearly that. The soft side of his heart was larger than the other side of it. It was his only defect, in her eyes. But she considered that his love for her, and worship of her, made up for it. He was a good hater, that was well, but it was a question if the materials of his hatreds were of as tough and enduring a quality as those of his friendships, and that was not so well. The years drifted on. Archie was become a handsome, shapely, athletic youth, courteous, dignified, companionable, pleasant in his ways, and looking perhaps a trifle older than he was, which was 16. One evening his mother said as he had something of grave importance to say to him, adding that he was old enough to hear it now, and old enough, and possessed of character enough, and stability enough to carry out a stern plan which as he had been for years contriving and maturing. Then she told him her bitter story, in all its naked atrociousness. For a while the boy was paralyzed. Then he said, "I understand. We are Southerners, and by our custom and nature there is but one atonement. I will search him out and kill him." "Kill him? No. Death is release, emancipation. Death is a favor. Do I owe him favors? You must not hurt a hair of his head." The boy was lost in thought a while, then he said, "You are all the world to me, and your desire is my law and my pleasure. Tell me what to do, and I will do it." The mother's eyes beamed with satisfaction, and she said, "You will go and find him. I have known his hiding place for 11 years. It cost me 5 years and more of inquiry, and much money, to locate it. He is a quartz miner in Colorado, and well-to-do. He lives in Denver. His name is Jacob Fuller. There, it is the first time I have spoken it since that unforgettable night. Think. That name could have been yours, if I had not saved you that shame, and furnished you a cleaner one. You will drive him from that place, you will hunt him down, and drive him again, and yet again, and again, and again, persistently, relentlessly, poisoning his life, filling it with mysterious terrors, loading it with weariness and misery, making him wish for death, and that he had a suicide's courage. You will make of him another wandering Jew. He shall know no rest any more, no peace of mind, no placid sleep. You shall shadow him, cling to him, persecute him, till you break his heart, as he broke my father's and mine. I will obey, mother. I believe it, my child. The preparations are all made. Everything is ready. Here is a letter of credit. Spend freely, there is no lack of money. At times you may need disguises. I have provided them, also some other conveniences." She took from the drawer of the typewriter table several squares of paper. They all bore these typewritten words. $10,000 reward. It is believed that a certain man who is wanted in an eastern state is sojourning here. In 1880, in the night, he tied his young wife to a tree by the public road, cut her across the face with a cowhide, and made his dogs tear her clothes from her, leaving her naked. He left her there, and fled the country. A blood relative of hers has searched for him for 17 years. Address. Post office. The above reward will be paid in cash to the person who will furnish the seeker, in a personal interview, the criminal's address. When you have found him, and acquainted yourself with his scent, you will go in the night and placard one of these upon the building he occupies, and another one upon the post office, or in some other prominent place. It will be the talk of the region. At first you must give him several days in which to force a sale of his belongings at something approaching their value. We will ruin him by and by, but gradually. We must not impoverish him at once, for that could bring him to despair, and injure his health, possibly kill him. She took three or four more typewritten forms from the drawer, duplicates, and read one.
.18.
To Jacob Fuller. You have .days in which to settle your affairs. You will not be disturbed during that limit, which will expire at .m on the .of You must then move on. If you are still in the place after the named hour, I will placard you on all the dead walls, detailing your crime once more, and adding the date, also the scene of it, with all names concerned, including your own. Have no fear of bodily injury, it will in no circumstances ever be inflicted upon you. You brought misery upon an old man, and ruined his life, and broke his heart. What he suffered, you are to suffer. You will add no signature. He must receive this, before he learns of the reward placard, before he rises in the morning, lest he lose his head and fly the place penniless. I shall not forget. You will need to use these forms only in the beginning, once may be enough. Afterward, when you are ready for him to vanish out of a place, see that he gets a copy of this form, which merely says, Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.